of affability that they would have shaken hands even with the banker's servants, so much did their gratitude need an object to expend itself upon. One thing above all the rest heightened the respect, nay, almost the veneration of Danglar for Cavalcanti. The latter, faithful to the principle of Horace, nil admirari, had contented himself in proving his knowledge by saying in what lake the best lampreys were caught. Then he had eaten some without saying a word. Danglar, therefore, concluded that these kind of luxuries were common at the table of the illustrious descendant of the Cavalcanti, who most likely in Lucca fed upon trout brought from Switzerland and lobsters sent from England by the same means used by the Count to bring the lampreys from the Lake Fusaro and the sterlet from the Volga. Thus it was with much politeness of manner that he heard Cavalcanti pronounce these words.
"Tomorrow, sir, I shall have the honour of waiting upon you on business."
"And I, sir," said Danglar, "shall be most happy to receive you."
Upon which he offered to take Cavalcanti in his carriage to the Hôtel de Prince, if it would not be depriving him of the company of his son. To this Cavalcanti replied by saying that for some time past his son had lived independently of him, that he had his own horses and carriages, and that, not having come together, it would not be difficult for them to leave separately. The major seated himself, therefore, by the side of Danglar, who was more and more charmed with the ideas of order and economy which ruled this man, and yet who, being able to allow his son 50,000 francs a year, might be supposed to possess a fortune of 500,000 or 600,000 livres. As for Andrea, he began, by way of showing off, to scold his groom, who, instead of bringing the tilbury to the steps of the house, had taken it to the outer door, thus giving him the trouble of walking 30 steps to reach it. The groom heard him with humility, took the bit of the impatient animal with his left hand, and with the right held out the reins to Andrea, who, taking them from him, rested his polished boot lightly on the step. At that moment a hand touched his shoulder. The young man turned round, thinking that Danglar or Monte Cristo had forgotten something they wished to tell him, and had returned just as they were starting. But instead of either of these, he saw nothing but a strange face, sunburnt and encircled by a beard, with eyes brilliant as carbuncles, and a smile upon the mouth which displayed a perfect set of white teeth, pointed and sharp as the wolf's or jackal's. A red handkerchief encircled his grey head. Torn and filthy garments covered his large bony limbs, which seemed as though, like those of a skeleton, they would rattle as he walked. And the hand with which he leant upon the young man's shoulder, and which was the first thing Andrea saw, seemed of a gigantic size. Did the young man recognize that face by the light of the lantern in his tilbury? Or was he merely struck with the horrible appearance of his interrogator? We cannot say, but only relate the fact that he shuddered and stepped back suddenly. "What do you want of me?" he asked.
"Pardon me, my friend, if I disturb you," said the man with the red handkerchief, "but I want to speak to you."
"You have no right to beg at night," said the groom, endeavouring to rid his master of the troublesome intruder.
"I am not begging, my fine fellow," said the unknown to the servant, with so ironical an expression of eye and so frightful a smile that he withdrew. "I only wish to say 2 or 3 words to your master, who gave me a commission to execute about a fortnight ago."
"Come," said Andrea, with sufficient nerve for his servant not to perceive his agitation. "What do you want? Speak quickly, friend." The man said in a low voice,
I wish you to spare me the walk back to Paris. I am very tired, and not having eaten so good a dinner as you have, I can scarcely support myself."
The young man shuddered at this strange familiarity. "Tell me," he said, "tell me what you want."
"Well, then, I want you to take me up in your fine carriage and carry me back."
Andrea turned pale but said nothing.
"Yes,"
said the man, thrusting his hands into his pockets and looking impudently at the youth. "I have taken the whim into my head. Do you understand, Master Benedetto?"
At this name, the young man, no doubt, reflected a little, for he went towards his groom, saying, "This man is right. I did indeed charge him with a commission, the result of which he must tell me. Walk to the barrier. There take a cab, that you may not be too late." The surprised groom retired.
"Let me at least reach a shady spot," said Andrea. "Oh, as for that, I'll conduct you to a splendid spot," said the man with the handkerchief, and taking the horse's bit, he led the tilbury to a place where it was certainly impossible for anyone to witness the honour that Andrea conferred upon him.
"Don't think I want the honour of riding in your fine carriage," said he. "Oh, no, it's only because I am tired, and also because I have a little business to talk over with you."
"Come, step in," said the young man.
It was a pity this scene had not occurred in daylight, for it was curious to see this rascal throwing himself heavily down on the cushion beside the young and elegant driver of the tilbury. Andrea drove past the last house in the village without saying a word to his companion, who smiled complacently, as though well pleased to find himself travelling in so comfortable a vehicle. Once out of Ortoi, Andrea looked around in order to assure himself that he could neither be seen nor heard, and then, stopping the horse and crossing his arms before the man, he asked, "Now, tell me why you come to disturb my tranquillity."
"Let me ask you why you deceived me."
"How have I deceived you?"
"How, do you ask? When we parted at the Pont du Far, you told me you were going to travel through Piedmont and Tuscany, but instead of that, you come to Paris."
"How does that annoy you?"
"It does not. On the contrary, I think it will answer my purpose."
"So," said Andrea, "you are speculating upon me."
"What fine words he uses! I warn you, Master Caderousse, that you are mistaken." "Well, well, don't be angry, my boy. You know well enough what it is to be unfortunate, and misfortunes make us jealous. I thought you were earning a living in Tuscany or Piedmont by acting as facchino or cicerone, and I pitied you sincerely, as I would a child of my own. You know I always did call you my child."
"Come, come, what then?"
"Patience, patience. I am patient, but go on. All at once, I see you pass through the barrier with a groom, a tilbury, and fine new clothes. You must have discovered a mine, or else become a stockbroker, so that, as you acknowledge, you are jealous." "No, I am pleased, so pleased that I wish to congratulate you. But as I am not quite properly dressed, I chose my opportunity that I might not compromise you."
"Yes, and a fine opportunity you have chosen," exclaimed Andrea.
"You speak to me before my servant." "How can I help that, my boy? I speak to you when I can catch you. You have a quick horse, a light tilbury. You are naturally as slippery as an eel. If I had missed you tonight, I might not have had another chance."
"You see, I do not conceal myself."
"You are lucky. I wish I could say as much. I do conceal myself, and then I was afraid you would not recognize me." "But you did," added Caderousse with his unpleasant smile. "It was very polite of you."
"Come," said Andrea, "what do you want?"
"You do not speak affectionately to me, Benedetto, my old friend. That is not right. Take care, or I may become troublesome."
This menace smothered the young man's passion. He trotted his horse on. "You should not speak so to an old friend like me, Caderousse. As you said just now, you are a native of Marseille. I am..."
"Do you know, then, now, what you are?"
"No, but I was brought up in Corsica. You are old and obstinate. I am young and wilful. Between folks like us, threats are out of place. Everything should be amicably arranged. Is it my fault if fortune, which has frowned on you, has been kind to me?
Fortune has been kind to you, then. Your tilbury, your groom, your clothes are not, then, hired? Good. So much the better, said Caderousse, his eyes sparkling with avarice.
Oh, you knew that well enough before speaking to me, said Andrea, becoming more and more excited. If I had been wearing a handkerchief like yours on my head, rags on my back, and worn-out shoes on my feet, you would not have known me.
You wrong me, my boy. Now I have found you, nothing prevents my being as well-dressed as anyone, knowing, as I do, the goodness of your heart. If you have two coats, you will give me one of them. I used to divide my soup and beans with you when you were hungry.
True, said Andrea.
What an appetite you used to have. Is it as good now?
Oh, yes, replied Andrea, laughing.
How did you come to be dining with that prince whose house you have just left?
He is not a prince, simply a count.
A count? And a rich one, too, eh?
Yes, but you had better not have anything to say to him, for he is not a very good-tempered gentleman.
Oh, be satisfied. I have no design upon your count, and you shall have him all to yourself.
But, said Caderousse, again smiling with the disagreeable expression he had before assumed,
you must pay for it. You understand?
Well, what do you want?
I think that with 100 francs per month...
Well,
I could live...
Upon 100 francs? Come, you understand me.
But that with... With 150 francs, I should be quite happy.
Here are 200, said Andrea, and he placed 10 louis d'or in the hand of Caderousse.
Good, said Caderousse.
Apply to the steward on the first day of every month, and you will receive the same sum.
There, now, again, you degrade me.
How so?
By making me apply to the servants, when I want to transact business with you alone.
Well, be it so, then. Take it from me, then, and so long, at least, as I receive my income, you shall be paid yours.
Come, come, I always said you were a fine fellow, and it is a blessing when good fortune happens to such as you. But tell me all about it.
Why do you wish to know? Asked Cavalcanti.
What? Do you again defy me?
No. The fact is, I have found my father.
What? A real father?
Yes. So long as he pays me,
you'll honour and believe him. That's right. What is his name?
Major Cavalcanti.
Is he pleased with you?
So far, I have appeared to answer his purpose.
And who found this father for you?
The Count of Monte Cristo.
The man whose house you have just left?
Yes.
I wish you would try and find me a situation with him as grandfather, since he holds the money chest.
Well, I will mention you to him. Meanwhile, what are you going to do?
I?
Yes, you.
It is very kind of you to trouble yourself about me.
Since you interest yourself in my affairs, I think it is now my turn to ask you some questions.
Ah, true.
Well, I shall rent a room in some respectable house, wear a decent coat, shave every day, and go and read the papers in a cafe. Then in the evening I will go to the theatre. I shall look like some retired baker. This is my wish.
Come, if you will only put this scheme into execution and be steady, nothing could be better.
Do you think so, Monsieur Bossuet?
And you, what will you become? A peer of France?
Ah, said Andrea, who knows?
Major Cavalcanti is already one, perhaps. But then hereditary rank is abolished.
No politics, Caderousse. And now that you have all you want and that we understand each other, jump down from the tilbury and disappear.
Not at all, my good friend.
How, not at all?
Why, Just think for a moment. With this red handkerchief on my head, with scarcely any shoes, no papers, and 10 gold napoleons in my pocket, without reckoning what was there before, making in all about 200 francs. Why, I should certainly be arrested at the barrier. Then, to justify myself, I should say that you gave me the money. This would cause inquiries. It would be found that I left Toulon without giving due notice, and I should then be reconducted to the shores of the Mediterranean. Then I should become simply number 106, and goodbye to my dream of resembling the retired baker. No, no, my boy. I prefer remaining honourably in the capital.
Andrea scowled. Certainly, as he had himself owned, the reputed son of Major Cavalcanti was a wilful fellow. He drew up for a minute, threw a rapid glance around him, and after doing so, his hand fell instantly into his pocket, where it began playing with a pistol. But meanwhile, Caderousse, who had never taken his eyes off his companion, passed his hand behind his back and unclasped a long Spanish knife, which he always carried with him to be ready in case of need. The two friends, as we see, were worthy of and understood one another. Andrea's hand left his pocket inoffensively and was carried up to the red mustachio, which it played with for some time.
"Good Caderousse," he said, "how happy you will be."
"I will do my best," said the innkeeper of the Pont du Gard, reclasping his knife.
"Well then, we will go into Paris. But how will you pass through the barrier without exciting suspicion? It seems to me that you are in more danger riding than on foot."
"Wait," said Caderousse. "You shall see."
He then took the greatcoat with the large collar, which the groom had left behind in the tilbury, and put it on his back. Then he took off Cavalcanti's hat, which he placed upon his own head, and finally assumed the careless attitude of a servant whose master drives himself.
"But tell me," said Andrea, "am I to remain bareheaded?"
"Pooh," said Caderousse, "it is so windy that your hat can easily appear to have blown off."
"Come, come, enough of this," said Cavalcanti.
"What are you waiting for?" said Caderousse. "I hope I am not the cause."
"Shoot!" exclaimed Andrea.
They passed the barrier without accident. At the first cross street, Andrea stopped his horse and Caderousse leaped out.
"Well," said Andrea, "my servant's coat and my hat?"
"Ah," said Caderousse, "you would not like me to risk taking cold."
"But what am I to do?"
"You? Oh, you are young, whilst I am beginning to get old. Au revoir, Benedetto."
And running into a court, he disappeared.
"Alas," said Andrea, sighing, "one cannot be completely happy in this world."
66. A Conjugal Scene. At the Place Louis XV, the three young people separated. That is to say, Morel went to the boulevard, Château Renaud to the Pont de la Révolution, and Debray to the quay. Most probably, Morel and Château Renaud returned to their domestic hearths, as they say in the gallery of the chamber in well-turned speeches, and in the theatre of the Rue Richelieu in well-written pieces. But it was not the case with Debray. When he reached the wicket of the Louvre, he turned to the left, galloped across the carousel, passed through the Rue Saint-Roch, and issuing from the Rue de la Michodière, he arrived at Monsieur Danglars' door, just at the same time that Vifor's landau, after having deposited him and his wife at the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, stopped to leave the Baroness at her own house. Debray, with the air of a man familiar with the house, entered first into the court, threw his bridle into the hands of a footman, and returned to the door to receive Madame Danglars, to whom he offered his arm to conduct her to her apartments. The gate once closed, and Debray and the Baroness alone in the court, he asked,
"What was the matter with you, Hermine? And why were you so affected at that story, or rather fable, which the Count related?" "Because I have been in such shocking spirits all the evening, my friend," said the Baroness.
"No, Hermine," replied Debray, "you cannot make me believe that. On the contrary, you were in excellent spirits when you arrived at the Count's. Monsieur Danglars was disagreeable, certainly, but I know how much you care for his ill-humour. Someone has vexed you. I will allow no one to annoy you."
"You are deceived, Lucien, I assure you," replied Madame Danglars. "And what I have told you is really the case, added to the ill-humour you remarked, but which I did not think it worthwhile to allude to."
It was evident that Madame Danglars was suffering from that nervous irritability which women frequently cannot account for, even to themselves, or that, as Debray had guessed, she had experienced some secret agitation that she would not acknowledge to anyone. Being a man who knew that the former of these symptoms was one of the elements of female life, he did not then press his inquiries, but waited for a more appropriate opportunity when he should again interrogate her, or receive an avowal proprio motu. At the door of her apartment, the Baroness met Mademoiselle Cornélie, her confidential lady's maid.
"What is my daughter doing?" asked Madame Danglars.
"She practiced all evening and then went to bed," replied Mademoiselle Cornélie.
"Yet I think I heard her piano. It is Mademoiselle Louise Dany, who is playing while Mademoiselle Danglars is in bed." "Well," said Madame Danglars, "come and undress me."
They entered the bedroom. Debray stretched himself upon a large couch, and Madame Danglars passed into her dressing-room with Mademoiselle Cornélie.
"My dear Monsieur Lucien," said Madame Danglars through the door, "you are always complaining that Eugénie will not address a word to you."
"Madame," said Lucien, playing with a little dog, who, recognizing him as a friend of the house, expected to be caressed,
"I am not the only one who makes similar complaints. I think I heard Morcerf say that he could not extract a word from his fiancée."
"True," said Madame Danglars, "but yet I think this will all pass off, and that you will one day see her enter your study."
"My study? At least that of the minister."
"Why so?" "To ask for an engagement at the opera. Really, I never saw such an infatuation for music. It is quite ridiculous for a young lady of fashion."
Debray smiled.
"Well," said he, "let her come, with your consent and that of the Baron, and we will try and give her an engagement, though we are very poor to pay such talent as hers."
"Go, Cornélie," said Madame Danglars. "I do not require you any longer."
Cornélie obeyed, and the next minute Madame Danglars left her room in a charming loose dress and came and sat down close to Debray. Then, thoughtful, she began to caress the little spaniel. Lucien looked at her for a moment in silence.
"Come, Hermine," he said after a short time, "answer candidly. Something vexes you. Is it not so?"
"Nothing," answered the Baroness.
And yet, as she could scarcely breathe, she rose and went towards a looking-glass.
"I am frightful tonight," she said.
Debray rose, smiling, and was about to contradict the Baroness upon this latter point, when the door opened suddenly. Monsieur Danglars appeared. Debray reseated himself. At the noise of the door, Madame Danglars turned round, and looked upon her husband with an astonishment she took no trouble to conceal.
"Good evening, madame," said the banker. "Good evening, Monsieur Debray."
Probably the Baroness thought this unexpected visit signified a desire to repair the sharp words he had uttered during the day. Assuming a dignified air, she turned round to Debray without answering her husband.
"Read me something, Monsieur Debray," she said.
Debray, who was slightly disturbed at this visit, recovered himself when he saw the calmness of the Baroness, and took up a book marked by a mother-of-pearl knife inlaid with gold.
"Excuse me," said the banker,
but you will tire yourself, Baroness, by such late hours, and Monsieur Debray lives some distance from here."
Debray was petrified, not only to hear Danglars speak so calmly and politely, but that it was apparent that beneath this forced appearance there really lurked a determined spirit of opposition to do anything his wife wished that evening. The Baroness was also surprised, and showed her astonishment by a look which would doubtless have had some effect upon her husband if he had not been intently occupied with the paper where he was seeking the closing price of the funds. The result was that the proud look entirely failed.
"Monsieur Lucien," said the Baroness, "I assure you I have no desire to sleep, and that I have a thousand things to tell you this evening, which you must listen to, even though you slept while hearing me."
"I am at your service, madame," replied Lucien coldly. "My dear Monsieur Debray," said the banker, "do not kill yourself tonight listening to the follies of Madame Danglars, for you can hear them as well tomorrow. But I claim tonight, and will dedicate it, if you will allow me, to talk over some serious matters with my wife."
This time the blow was so well aimed, and hit so directly, that Lucien and the Baroness were staggered, and they interrogated each other with their eyes, as if to seek help against this aggression. But the irresistible will of the master of the house prevailed, and the husband was victorious.
"Do not think I wish to turn you out, my dear Debray," continued Danglars. "Oh, no, not at all. An unexpected occurrence forces me to ask my wife to have a little conversation with me. It is so rarely I make such a request. I am sure you cannot grudge it to me."
Debray muttered something, bowed, and went out, knocking himself against the edge of the door, like Nathan in Athalie.
"It is extraordinary," he said when the door was closed behind him, "how easily these husbands whom we ridicule gain an advantage over us."
Lucien having left, Danglars took his place on the sofa, closed the open book, and, placing himself in a dreadfully dictatorial attitude, he began playing with the dog. But the animal, not liking him so well as Debray, and attempting to bite him, Danglars seized him by the skin of his neck and threw him to the other side of the room upon a couch. The animal uttered a cry during his transit, but, arrived at its destination, it crouched behind the cushions and, stupefied at such unusual treatment, remained silent and motionless.
"Do you know, sir," asked the Baroness, "that you are improving? Generally you are only rude, but tonight you are brutal."
"It is because I am in a worse humour than usual," replied Danglars.
Hermine looked at the banker with supreme disdain. These glances frequently exasperated the pride of Danglars, but this evening he took no notice of them.
"And what have I to do with your ill humour?" said the Baroness, irritated at the impassibility of her husband. "Do these things concern me?" "Keep your ill humour at home in your chests, or, since you have clerks whom you pay, vent it upon them."
"Not so," replied Danglars. "Your advice is wrong, so I shall not follow it. My chests are my pactolus, as I think Monsieur de Moustier says, and I will not retard its course or disturb its calm. My clerks are honest men who earn my fortune, whom I pay much below their deserts, if I may value them according to what they bring in. Therefore, I shall not get into a passion with them. Those with whom I will be in a passion are those who eat my dinners, mount my horses, and exhaust my fortune."
"And pray, who are the persons who exhaust your fortune? Explain yourself more clearly, I beg, sir."
"Oh, make yourself easy. I am not speaking riddles, and you will soon know what I mean. The people who exhaust my fortune are those who draw out 700,000 francs in the course of an hour.
"I do not understand you, sir," said the Baroness, trying to disguise the agitation of her voice and the flush of her face.
"You understand me perfectly, on the contrary," said Danglars. "But if you will persist, I will tell you that I have just lost 700,000 francs upon the Spanish loan."
"And pray," asked the Baroness, "am I responsible for this loss?"
"Why not?
Is it my fault you have lost 700,000 francs?
"Certainly it is not mine."
"Once for all, sir," replied the Baroness sharply, "I tell you I will not hear cash named. It is a style of language I never heard in the house of my parents or in that of my first husband."
"Oh, I can well believe that, for neither of them was worth a penny."
"The better reason for my not being conversant with the slang of the bank, which is here dinning in my ears from morning to night. That noise of crowns jingling, which are constantly being counted and recounted, is odious to me. I only know one thing I dislike more, which is the sound of your voice."
"Really?" said Danglars. "Well, this surprises me, for I thought you took the liveliest interest in my affairs."
"I? What could put such an idea into your head?"
"Yourself."
"Ah, what next?"
"Most assuredly, I should like to know upon what occasion." "Ah, that is very easily done. Last February, you were the first who told me of the Haitian funds. You had dreamt that a ship had entered the harbour at Havre, that this ship brought news that a payment we had looked upon as lost was going to be made. I know how clear-sighted your dreams are. I therefore purchased immediately as many shares as I could of the Haitian debt, and I gained 400,000 francs by it, of which 100,000 have been honestly paid to you. You spent it as you pleased. That was your business. In March there was a question about a grant to a railway. Three companies presented themselves, each offering equal securities. You told me that your instinct, and although you pretend to know nothing about speculations, I think, on the contrary, that your comprehension is very clear upon certain affairs. Well, you told me that your instinct led you to believe the grant would be given to the company called the Southern. I bought 2/3 of the shares of that company. As you had foreseen, the shares became of triple value, and I picked up £1,040,000, from which 250,000 francs were paid to you for pin money. How have you spent this 250,000 francs? It is no business of mine."
"When are you coming to the point?" cried the Baroness, shivering with anger and impatience.
"Patience, madame. I am coming to it."
"That's fortunate."
"In April, you went to dine at the minister's. You heard a private conversation respecting the affairs of Spain on the expulsion of Don Carlos. I bought some Spanish shares. The expulsion took place, and I pocketed 600,000 francs the day Charles V repassed the bidder sower. Of these 600,000 francs, you took 50,000 crowns. They were yours. You disposed of them according to your fancy, and I asked no questions. But it is not the less true that you have this year received 500,000 livres.
"Well, sir, and what then?"
"Ah, yes, it was just after this that you spoiled everything."
"Really? Your manner of speaking..."
"It expresses my meaning, and that is all I want." "Well, 3 days after that you talked politics with Monsieur de Bray, and you fancied from his words that Don Carlos had returned to Spain. Well,
I sold my shares. The news was spread, and I no longer sold, but gave them. Next day I find the news was false, and by this false report I have lost 700,000 francs.
Well?
Well, since I give you a fourth of my gains, I think you owe me a fourth of my losses. The fourth of 700,000 francs is 175,000 francs. What you say is absurd, and I cannot see why Monsieur de Bray's name is mixed up in this affair, because if you do not possess the 175,000 francs I reclaim, you must have lent them to your friends, and Monsieur de Bray is one of your friends.
For shame! Exclaimed the Baroness.
Oh, let us have no gestures, no screams, no modern drama, or you will oblige me to tell you that I see de Bray leave here, pocketing nearly the whole of the 500,000 livres you have handed over to him this year, while he smiles to himself, saying that he has found that which the most skilful players have never discovered. That is, a roulette where he wins without paying and is no loser when he loses.
The Baroness became enraged.
Wretch, she cried, will you dare to tell me you did not know that with which you now reproach me?
I do not say that I did know it, and I do not say that I did not know it. I merely tell you to look into my conduct during the last 4 years that we have ceased to be husband and wife, and see whether it has not always been consistent. Some time after our rupture, you wished to study music under the celebrated baritone who made such a successful debut at the Théâtre Italien. At the same time, I felt inclined to learn dancing of the danseurs who acquired such a reputation in London. This cost me, on your account and mine, about 100,000 francs. I said nothing, for we must have peace in the house, and 100,000 francs for a lady and gentleman to be properly instructed in music and dancing are not too much. Well, you soon became tired of singing, and you take a fancy to study diplomacy with the minister's secretary. You understand it signifies nothing to me so long as you pay for your lessons out of your own cash box. But today I find you are drawing on mine, and that your apprenticeship may cost me 700,000 francs per month. Stop there, madame, for this cannot last. Either the diplomatist must give his lessons gratis, and I will tolerate him, or he must never set his foot again in my house. Do you understand, madame?
Oh, this is too much, cried Hermine, choking. You are worse than despicable.
But, continued Danglars, I find you did not even pause there.
Insults!
You are right. Let us leave these facts alone and reason coolly. I have never interfered in your affairs, excepting for your good. Treat me in the same way. You say you have nothing to do with my cash-box. Be it so. Do as you like with your own, but do not fill or empty mine. Besides, how do I know that this was not a political trick, that the minister, enraged at seeing me in the opposition and jealous of the popular sympathy I excite, has not concerted with Monsieur de Bray to ruin me?
A probable thing.
Why not? Whoever heard of such an occurrence as this?
A false telegraphic despatch.
It is almost impossible for signals to have been made different to those of the two last telegraphs. It was done on purpose for me. I am sure of it.
Sir, said the Baroness humbly, are you not aware that the man employed there was dismissed,
that they talked of going to law with him, that orders were issued to arrest him, and that this order would have been put into execution if he had not escaped their researches by a flight, which proves either his madness or his culpability. It was a mistake.
Yes, which made fools laugh, which caused the minister to have a sleepless night, which has caused the minister's secretaries to blacken several sheets of paper, but which has cost me 700,000 francs.
But, sir, said Hermine suddenly, if all this is, as you say, caused by Monsieur de Bray, why, instead of going direct to him, do you come and tell me of it? Why, to accuse the man, do you address the woman?
Do I know Monsieur de Bray? Do I wish to know him? Do I wish to know that he gives advice? Do I wish to follow it? Do I speculate? No. You do all this, not I.
Still, it seems to me that as you profit by it...
Danglars shrugged his shoulders.
Foolish creature, he exclaimed. Women fancy they have talent because they have managed two or three intrigues without being the talk of Paris. But know that if you had even hidden your irregularities from your husband, which is but the commencement of the art, for generally husbands will not see, you would then have been a faint imitation of most of your friends among the women of the world. But it has not been so with me. I see, and always have seen, during the last 16 years. You may perhaps have hidden a thought, but not a step, not an action, not a fault has escaped me, while you flattered yourself upon your address, and firmly believed you had deceived me. What has been the result? That, thanks to my pretended ignorance, there are none of your friends from Monsieur de Villefort to Monsieur de Bray who have not trembled before me. There is not one who has not treated me as the master of the house, the only title I desire with respect to you. There is not one, in fact, who would have dared to speak of me as I have spoken of them this day. I will allow you to make me hateful, but I will prevent you rendering me ridiculous, and above all, I forbid you to ruin me.
The Baroness had been tolerably composed until the name of Villefort had been pronounced, but then she became pale, and rising, as if touched by a spring, she stretched out her hands as though conjuring an apparition. She then took two or three steps towards her husband, as though to tear the secret from him, of which he was ignorant, or which he withheld from some odious calculation, as all his calculations were.
Monsieur de Villefort, what do you mean?
I mean that Monsieur de Nargon, your first husband, being neither a philosopher nor a banker, or perhaps being both, and seeing there was nothing to be got out of a procureur du roi, died of grief or anger at finding, after an absence of 9 months, that you had been enceinte 6. I am brutal. I not only allow it, but boast of it. It is one of the reasons of my success in commercial business. Why did he kill himself instead of you? Because he had no cash to save. My life belongs to my cash. Monsieur de Bray has made me lose 700,000 francs. Let him bear his share of the loss, and we will go on as before. If not, let him become bankrupt for the 250,000 livres, and do as all bankrupts do, disappear. He is a charming fellow, I allow, when his news is correct, but when it is not, there are 50 others in the world who would do better than he.
Madame Danglars was rooted to the spot. She made a violent effort to reply to this last attack, but she fell upon a chair, thinking of Villefort, of the dinner scene, of the strange series of misfortunes which had taken place in her house during the last few days, and changed the usual calm of her establishment to a scene of scandalous debate. Danglars did not even look at her, though she tried all she could to faint. He shut the bedroom door after him without adding another word, and returned to his apartments. And when Madame Danglars recovered from her half-fainting condition, she could almost believe she had had a disagreeable dream. 67. Matrimonial Plans. The day following this scene, at the hour the banker usually chose to pay a visit to Madame Danglars on his way to his office, his coupé did not appear in the court. At this time, that is, about 12:30, Madame Danglars ordered her carriage and went out. Danglars, placed behind a curtain, watched the departure he had been waiting for. He gave orders that he should be informed directly Madame Danglars appeared, but at 2:00 she had not returned. He then called for his horses, drove to the chamber, and inscribed his name to speak against the budget. From 12 to 2:00, Danglars had remained in his study, unsealing his despatches and becoming more and more sad every minute, heaping figure upon figure, and receiving, among other visits, one from Major Cavalcanti, who, as stiff and as exact as ever, presented himself precisely at the hour named the night before to terminate his business with the banker. On leaving the chamber, Danglars, who had shown violent marks of agitation during the sitting and been more bitter than ever against the ministry, re-entered his carriage and told the coachman to drive to the Avenue des Champs-Élysées, number 30. Monte Cristo was at home, only he was engaged with someone and begged Danglars to wait for a moment in the drawing-room. While the banker was waiting, the door opened, and a man dressed as an abbé entered, who, doubtless more familiar with the house than he was, instead of waiting, merely bowed and, passing on to the further apartments, disappeared. A minute after, the door by which the priest had entered reopened, and Monte Cristo appeared. "Pardon me," said he, "my dear Baron, but one of my friends, the Abbé Busoni, whom you perhaps saw pass by, has just arrived in Paris. Not having seen him for a long time, I could not make up my mind to leave him sooner, so I hope this will be sufficient reason for my having made you wait." "Nay," said Danglars, "it is my fault. I have chosen my visit at a wrong time and will retire." "Not at all. On the contrary, be seated. But what is the matter with you? You look careworn. Really, you alarm me. For a capitalist to be sad, like the appearance of a comet, presages some misfortune to the world." "I have been in ill luck for several days," said Danglars, "and I have heard nothing but bad news." "Ah, indeed," said Monte Cristo. "Have you had another fall at the Bourse?" "No, I am safe for a few days at least. I am only annoyed about a bankrupt of Trieste."
"Really? Does it happen to be Jacopo Manfredi?"
"Exactly so. Imagine a man who has transacted business with me for I do not know how long, to the amount of 800,000 or 900,000 francs during the year. Never a mistake or delay, a fellow who paid like a prince. Well, I was a million in advance with him, and now my fine Jacopo Manfredi suspends payment."
"Really,
it is an unheard-of fatality. I draw upon him for 600,000 francs. My bills are returned unpaid, and more than that, I hold bills of exchange signed by him to the value of 400,000 francs payable at his correspondence in Paris at the end of this month. Today is the 30th. I present them, but my correspondent has disappeared. This, with my Spanish affairs, made a pretty end to the month."
"Then you really lost by that affair in Spain?"
"Yes. Only 700,000 francs out of my cash box, nothing more."
"Why? How could you make such a mistake? Such an old stager."
"Oh, it is all my wife's fault. She dreamed Don Carlos had returned to Spain. She believes in dreams.
It is magnetism, she says, and when she dreams a thing, it is sure to happen, she assures me. On this conviction, I allow her to speculate. She has her bank and her stockbroker. She speculated and lost. It is true she speculates with her own money, not mine. Nevertheless, you can understand that when 700,000 francs leave the wife's pocket, the husband always finds it out.
But do you mean to say you have not heard of this? Why, the thing has made a tremendous noise.
Yes, I heard it spoken of, but I did not know the details. And then, no one can be more ignorant than I am of the affairs in the Bourse.
Then you do not speculate?
I? How could I speculate when I already have so much trouble in regulating my income? I should be obliged, besides my steward, to keep a clerk and a boy. But touching these Spanish affairs, I think the Baroness did not dream the whole of this entrance of Don Carlos. The papers said something about it, did they not?
Well, this is what puzzles me, replied Danglars. The news of the return of Don Carlos was brought by telegraph.
So that, said Monte Cristo, you have lost nearly 1,700,000 francs this month.
Not nearly, indeed. That is exactly my loss.
Diable, said Monte Cristo compassionately. It is a hard blow for a third-rate fortune.
Third-rate? Said Danglars, rather humbled. What do you mean by that?
Certainly, continued Monte Cristo, I make three assortments in fortunes. First-rate, second-rate, and third-rate fortunes. I call those first-rate which are composed of treasures one possesses under one's hand, such as mines, lands, and funded property, in such states as France, Austria, and England, provided these treasures and property form a total of about 100 millions. I call those second-rate fortunes gained by manufacturing enterprises, joint stock companies, viceroyalties and principalities, not drawing more than 1,500,000 francs, the whole forming a capital of about 50 millions. Finally, I call those third-rate fortunes composed of a fluctuating capital dependent upon the will of others or upon chances which a bankruptcy involves or a false telegraph shakes, such as banks, speculations of the day, in fact, all operations under the influence of greater or less mischances, the whole bringing in a real or fictitious capital of about 15 millions. I think this is about your position, is it not?
Confound it, yes, replied Danglars.
The result, then, of six more such months as this would be to reduce the third-rate house to despair.
Oh, said Danglars, becoming very pale. How you are running on!
Let us imagine seven such months, continued Monte Cristo in the same tone. Tell me, have you ever thought that 7 times 1,700,000 francs make nearly 12 millions? No, you have not. Well, you are right, for if you indulged in such reflections, you would never risk your principal, which is to the speculator what the skin is to civilized man. We have our clothes, some more splendid than others. This is our credit. But when a man dies, he has only his skin. In the same way, on retiring from business, you have nothing but your real principal of about 5 or 6 millions at the most, for third-rate fortunes are never more than the fourth of what they appear to be, like the locomotive on a railway, the size of which is magnified by the smoke and steam surrounding it. Well, out of the 5 or 6 millions which form your real capital, you have just lost nearly 2 millions, which must, of course, in the same degree, diminish your credit and fictitious fortune. To follow out my simile, your skin has been opened by bleeding, which, repeated 3 or 4 times, will cause death. So pay attention to it, Monsieur Danglars. Do you want money? Do you wish me to lend you some?
"What a bad calculator you are!" exclaimed Dangla, calling to his assistance all his philosophy and dissimulation. "I have made money at the same time by speculations which have succeeded. I have made up for the loss of blood by nutrition. I lost a battle in Spain. I have been defeated in Trieste, but my naval army in India will have taken some galleons, and my Mexican pioneers will have discovered some mine."
"Very good, very good. But the wound remains and will reopen at the first loss."
"No, for I am only embarked in certainties," replied Dangla, with the air of a mountebank sounding out his own praises. "To involve me, three governments must crumble to dust."
"So much the better, my dear Monsieur Dangla," said Monte Cristo. "I see I was deceived, and that you belong to the class of second-rate fortunes."
"I think I may aspire to that honour," said Dangla with a sickly smile. "But while we are speaking of business," he added, pleased to find an opportunity of changing the subject, "tell me what I am to do for Monsieur Cavalcanti."
"Give him money, if he is recommended to you, and the recommendation seems good."
"Excellent. He presented himself this morning with a bond of 40,000 francs, payable at sight, on you, signed by Busoni, and returned by you to me with your endorsement. Of course, I immediately counted him over the 40 banknotes."
Monte Cristo nodded his head in token of assent.
"But that is not all," continued Dangla. "He has opened an account with my house for his son."
"May I ask how much he allows the young man?"
5,000 francs per month.
60,000 francs per year."
"I thought I was right in believing that Cavalcanti to be a stingy fellow. How can a young man live upon 5,000 francs a month? But you understand that if the young man should want a few thousands more, do not advance it.
The father will never repay it. You do not know these ultramontane millionaires. They are regular misers." "And by whom were they recommended to you?"
"Oh, by the House of Fenzi, one of the best in Florence.
I do not mean to say you will lose, but nevertheless, mind you hold to the terms of the agreement."
"Would you not trust the Cavalcanti?"
"I? Oh, I would advance 6 millions on his signature. I was only speaking in reference to the second-rate fortunes we were mentioning just now."
"And with all this, how plain he is! I should never have taken him for anything more than a mere major, and you would have flattered him, for certainly, as you say, he has no manner.
The first time I saw him, he appeared to me like an old lieutenant who had grown mouldy beneath his epaulette. But all the Italians are the same. They are like old Jews when they are not glittering in oriental splendour."
"The young man is better," said Dangla.
"Yes, a little nervous, perhaps, but upon the whole, he appeared tolerable. I was uneasy about him."
"Why?"
"Because you met him at my house, just after his introduction into the world, as they told me. He has been travelling with a very severe tutor, and had never been to Paris before."
"Ah, I believe noblemen marry amongst themselves, do they not?" asked Dangla carelessly. "They like to unite their fortunes?"
"It is usual, certainly. But Cavalcanti is an original who does nothing like other people. I cannot help thinking he has brought his son to France to choose a wife."
"Do you think so?"
"I am sure of it."
"And you have heard his fortune mentioned?"
"Nothing else was talked of. Only some said he was worth millions, and others that he did not possess a farthing."
"And what is your opinion?"
"I ought not to influence you, because it is only my own personal impression."
"Well, and it is that..."
My opinion is that all these old podestas, these ancient condottieri, for the Cavalcanti have commanded armies and governed provinces. My opinion, I say, is that they have buried their millions in corners, the secret of which they have only transmitted to their eldest sons, who have done the same from generation to generation. And the proof of this is seen in their yellow and dry appearance, like the florins of the Republic, which, from being constantly gazed upon, have become reflected in them. Oh, as I told you before, I think the good man very close. Come.